Committee on Veterans Affairs this morning. And today is Thursday, January 20th, and we have a very important presentation on today's agenda. As we begin this morning, I would just like to let the members of our audience know that we do have, in effect, a penalty box, just in case anyone should determine an acronym fits better in what they're saying than the full words. And yes, and there is a basket, and everyone's on their honor as they leave. If you know you're guilty of this, we hope you'll make a donation to our Veterans Fund.
The record should show that Colonel Caldwell is going for his wallet.
Yes.
And Madam Chair, since we are a bipartisan committee and I'm an Army Reserve officer and the General's in the National Guard, I'll cover his first four penalties. No more than that.
That's very generous, Representative Boquist. Thank you. At this time, I would certainly like to introduce former State Representative Pat Farr. And back here, would you stand, please? He is now the head of the food bank in Eugene. And we're very proud and we're delighted that his wife, Debbie, is our vice chair of this committee. And welcome, Representative. Okay. Yes. Is that right? For goodness sake. It's a small world, isn't it? Well, we're just incredibly honored today to open an informational meeting and have as our speaker our beloved and highly respected General Ray Byrne, and we want to welcome you here today. And along with General Byrne is the unbelievably accomplished Colonel Mike Caldwell. I've never understood in all my years in the House how he spreads his action and activities over such a broad area. So we're just delighted that you're here. And also we recognize Major Lane in Cabo, who has accompanied the General. And we're just so grateful that you're here. Also, before you leave, following your testimony, we would like very much, since this is our purpose, to have a group picture with you before, if we could, please, before you leave today. Okay. Also, at this time, I'd just like to recognize veterans in our audience and or current military servicemen. And if you'd stand, we'd like to recognize all of you in this room today. Or raise your hand. Thank you very much for your service. And we know that freedom isn't free and wasn't free, and we're grateful for you. Okay. Gentlemen, let's begin. And who will be beginning today? General Byrne? Okay, if you will, just identify yourself and proceed. Thank
you. I'm Brigadier General Ray Byrne, the Acting Adjutant General for the State of Oregon. And then you've recognized Colonel Mike Caldwell and Major Lane and Cabo, who's my aide. We potentially, Mr. Craig Campbell, Public Safety Policy Advisor to my boss, the Commander-in-Chief, Governor Kulongoski, may be here also at some point. Before you should have, each of you should have a set of slides. Do we have the slides out yet?
No.
Lane?
We are in the process of getting enough for the entire committee.
Okay.
So just to send us
we had eight. We can wait for a second. But I'd also like to pass out to you, as part of an education process, a book that is put out by the National Guard Association. It's called I Am the Guard, A History of the National Guard, 1636 to 2000. Lane will pass one to each member of the committee.
That is wonderful.
That's this really is an excellent excellent book. It has basically the total history of the National Guard. And as you go through there, you'll see Oregon and the 41st Division represented throughout, especially World War I, World War II, and post-World War II, and other Oregon units, too.
Is this wonderful?
Yeah.
Now we're going to start on chapter one and read
through it.
There will be three and a half hours. You're going to be busy. So.
And it will be a test.
But yes, at the end.
Well, we ought to be able to prove literacy does exist here in the legislature after we get through. Well, that is so wonderful, and thank you so very much. We greatly appreciate it. I was reading in the newspaper just last night where in the state of Texas, Ross Perot had donated the new book, I guess it's a new one, of all the Medal of Honor winners. And he was donating copies to every public school in Texas. And he said, I want them to see, you know, the sacrifices were made, so lest we forget them. And I thought, that is incredible. That's wonderful. And this is a great book that should, I'll just ask and find out, see if it's in our libraries.
If you're interested at some point in time, if you're in Indianapolis, the National Center for Medal of Honor is located. They have a facility that commemorates all the Medal of Honor winners in Indianapolis. So if you're ever through there, have an opportunity to see it. It's a very moving place.
Oh, I think that is. Did not know that. Okay, I believe now...
Everybody have some slides?
We have copies.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Today, as you begin your session, I thought it would be best to give you an overview of the Oregon National Guard, our missions, and our structure. Unlike most of the state agencies that come before you, the legislature, the National Guard is part of both the U.S. Constitution and the Oregon Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, under the powers of Congress, states in part to provide for the calling forth the militia, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections and repel invasions, and to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserved to the states respectively, the appointment of officers, and authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Basically, Congress, the federal, has the responsibility for providing support, and the governors for appointing the officers. The federal has responsibility for disciplining. So this was originally stated in the original Constitution, and again, the purpose behind that, based upon English history, was to have a small, regular force and a strong militia, and that comes out of the English Civil War and the Cromwell era. Also, Article 10, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution states, the Legislative Assembly shall provide by law for the organization, maintenance, and discipline of the state militia for defense and protection of the state. The federal Constitution also says that the Congress has the power to provide and maintain a navy. In fact, the militia, the forerunner of the modern-day National Guard, was the principal group of Americans responsible for defending the nation, except for the navy. One could clearly argue that the Founding Fathers did not want a large standing army, and that when, if we ever needed one, we would raise the army from the militia, as is stated in the Constitution. Prior to the end of World War II, this nation maintained a small standing army. At the beginning of World War II, 130,000 active. And when the nation went to war, they called on the militia to man the ranks of the army to fight our wars. In other words, we raised an army from the militia. The Cold War, post-World War II, was the first time in our history that we did not shrink our standing army after a conflict. The Guard was regulated to a deep reserve force that was only envisioned to mobilize and deploy in the event of a major global conflict of World War III. After the Cold War ended, the U.S. Army did shrink by 6 combat divisions from 16 to 10. Today, we the National Guard have been called for deployment around the world. The Oregon National Guard has deployed 67% of our total force over the last several years. As you can see by the chart, Oregon has contributed heavily to the defense of the nation as envisioned by the founding fathers. Most Americans don't see us in the current light, and we become accustomed to the Guard being a state force that they mistakenly believe is supposed to stay at home and fight fires, floods, etc. In fact, the Oregon Guard is fulfilling its constitutional role for the first time in over 60 years. Our history tells us that the founding fathers debated long and hard on how this republic should defend itself. They were extremely concerned of providing for and maintaining a large standing army. In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton wrote in part in Federalist 29 the following: "It is a matter of the utmost importance that a well-digested plan should as soon as possible be adopted for the proper establishment of the militia." He also wrote in part, "The formation of a select corps of moderate size upon which principles as they will really fit it for service in case of need. By thus circumscribing the plan, it will be possible to have an excellent body of well-trained militia ready to take to the field whenever the defense of the state shall require it. This will not only lessen the call for military establishments, but if circumstances should be at any time oblige the government to form an army of any magnitude, that the army can never be formidable to the liberties of the people, while there is a large body of citizens, little if at all, inferior to them in discipline and the use of arms, who stand ready to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens. This appears to me the only substitute that can be devised for a standing army, the best possible security against it, if it should exist. Federalist 29 is a principal part of our founding fathers' view of how this republic should and must have a military, albeit an 18th century view, but nonetheless a principal plank in what we should do to defend the nation with its citizens, and not a large professional army that may be less respectful of the political ups and downs we seem to have in Americans. We are the only nation on earth that has a militia that is governed both by a state governor, trained and disciplined by the federal Congress, and able to be called into federal service by the president. From the Guard standpoint, this is not only a good thing, but in time of peace, it should save the taxpayers millions of dollars to not maintain a large standing army. Unfortunately, over the past 60 years, due to the Cold War, we were forced to maintain a large standing military and spend millions of dollars maintaining a large standing active military, and many, if not most, Americans believe that this is the norm. Now, it appears that we are outside the norm with the Guard call-ups. In fact, we are back to the norm as our founding fathers envisioned. With that backdrop, I will tell you about the Oregon National Guard. The Oregon National Guard is comprised of 8,200 citizen soldiers and airmen. The National Guard structure has 6,100 members with a force structure requirement for 6,900. The Air National Guard has 2,100 airmen with a force structure requirement for 2,200. So as you can see up there, we're about 800 short on the Army side and about 100 short on the Air side. The state's primary responsibility is this unique relationship with the federal government, is to house and administer the units that are assigned in Oregon. Go to the map. As you can see by this map, we are located throughout Oregon with 38 armories, 2 air bases, and 6 major training areas. I will go into further detail on this slide. But as you look at the slide, primarily along the interstate this direction, down south the I-5 corridor, and then primarily in the Ben Redmond area, Burns and Klamath Falls. Got to make sure I don't hit an airplane with this.
Wrong color.
Oh, okay. In the Air National Guard, we have our 2 air bases, 173rd Fighter Wing in Kingsley Field in Klamath Falls. And the 142nd Fighter Wing in Portland, along with several support squadrons and a medical clinic. Also, we have the 116th Air Control Squadron at Camp Rylea, and the Air Guard National Headquarters Air Guard headquarters here in Salem. Our five training areas offer a variety of training experiences for both the Army and the Air Guard, as well as firing ranges, billeting, classrooms, and a host of other training opportunities for us in law enforcement throughout our state. We have had use of our facilities and training areas by all of the other uniformed services and numerous federal and state law enforcement agencies. Camp Riley is home of the Oregon State Police Academy and the State High Voltage Electrical Training Center, as well as the Joint Apprentice Training and Certification. At Camp Adair, between Monmouth and Corvallis, we have a small arms training, small training area and a rifle and pistol range that we utilize along with partnership with DPSST. Also, we offer these facilities to the community for a fee, and we have numerous groups who are regular users. Okay. These exclusive facilities are primarily supported by the federal government. The state of Oregon supports the Portland Air Base's utility and maintenance costs up to 20% or $961,000 per biennium. At Kingsley Field, the state support is 15% for the same or $722,000 per biennium. Camp Riley has not received state general fund dollars since 1997. It is exclusively supported by the federal agreements and by the revenue earned by leasing to different users like the OSP. Camp Withycombe receives $1.1 million in state, other, and general funds for operations, but like Rylea, is predominantly federally funded. Our armories are a different story. Armories are a state responsibility as stated in ORS 399.105. As you can see by the current armory condition chart, our facilities are in decline. Basically, the green are meet standards, the amber is adequate, and the red is below standard. And I'll go into some detail with some of these. Our two oldest armories are the Dallas and Cottage Grove armories. The Cottage Grove Army will be replaced by 2006 as we are closing it and consolidating the unit, 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, currently serving in Iraq, into a new Armed Forces Reserve Center we are building in partnership with the Marine Corps Reserve in Springfield. This building will be approximately 96% funded by federal government. By partnering with Marine Corps Reserve, we are able to get a larger federal share of the construction costs.
Great.
Normally, an armory is 70% federal and 30% state in construction costs. So you see, there's, and that's been the norm is to over the last several years is to do multi-component or multi-use armories. It just makes sense. The next class of armories we have are post-World War II facilities, and here we have two examples: Hood River and Gresham. This group of armories has served us well, but we are experiencing a host of issues like heating plant replacements, lack of adequate kitchens and administrative areas, as well as electrical and telephone issues. Needless to say, we wish we could be upgrade these armories on a regular basis to modernize them for our needs, but unfortunately, we've only been able to do the minimum maintenance with a reduction in state funds over the past decade. In fact, the only substantial repairs we have done in this class of facilities was when the National Guard Bureau was offered $50 for heating plant roofs, etc. In these instances, we have come to the E-Board to get the required matching funds, and we have been successful in keeping these as well as older armories dry and functional. The final class of armories in our new post-1980 armories is the new post-1980 armories, such as the Forest Grove, Bend, LeGrand, Hermiston, and Baker armories. We have been successful in replacing several armories throughout the state, primarily since 1988, with former Senator Mark Hatfield as chairman of the Senate Appropriations. We were able to build seven new armories and remodel two more. Much of the state's share in this new arm reconstruction was initially funded by the sale of a portion of Camp Withicum, as the general funds were not allocated due to budget issues. Since these funds have long been expended, we have sought and received certificates of participation, COPs, to fund the state's share. This, of course, has expanded our debt substantially, but we have been able to take advantage of the sorely needed new facilities. Presently, we have several new construction projects that are federal funds and will be constructed over the next 2 years. There are the Salem Flight Facility and CST, there's one quarter, with Civil Support Team. $7.5 million federal and $980,000 state COP. The Lane County AFRC, Armed Forces Reserve Center.
Two quarters. Good. Take one back.
$13 million federal and $4 million state COPs. $10 million Navy Reserve, U.S. Marine Corps Reserve, and $2.5 million from the U.S. Forest Service.
Thank you. Excuse me,
sure.
General Byrne, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. General, I really appreciate your expanding the acronyms when you catch yourself, because I don't know them, and I'll learn more about it if I get the expanded version rather than the acronym. So I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'll catch myself.
Thank you.
If you don't, of course, because we have a fund, I'm catching them. I'll be your backup.
I got two more to go. We anticipate that this session of Congress will also provide federal funds for the construction of armories in Ontario and the Dalles.
On the Lane County?
Sure.
Was this one of them that we saw that was pre-80?
I'm sorry, for what again?
Was it pre-1980 building?
Which armory?
This one, this Lane County.
Lane County FRC. No, that's the one that's, we just broke ground on the maintenance facility, okay, which will be followed by the full armory.
Okay.
So that's been fully funded.
And Madam Chairman, we're going to close Cottage Grove,
right,
and sell it. We've already sold the Eugene Armory to the county, and we'll consolidate those two units into this site in Springfield, and we're calling it the Lane County Armed Forces Reserve Center, which includes the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Forest Service. They came to us and asked to partner with us because of their issues, and we think that's a pretty good deal because we can use them to help supply funds to maintain the overall facility.
So out of the troop number, I wrote 6,900, I believe. How many men can this facility serve? Is there a capacity issue?
It'll be designed, the battalion headquarters and the units will be about 450 plus the Navy, probably about 600, 650 people total will be in the armory, in addition to the number of personnel from the Forest Service. It's going to be a very large facility.
Well, Representative Farr, I think you've got a new building.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very excited about it.
Okay, we'll work on our, rest of us will work on ours now.
I must say that.
Oh, that's yours too.
Madam Chair, I think that's either in or very near my district.
I was trying to say, excuse me.
So I'm very happy.
You're happy too. Okay, well, two happy members up here.
Well, actually, right. I have to say it's actually in Representative Byer's district.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But Representative Barnhart and myself can appreciate the new building.
Okay. Yeah. Great.
Well, it will have definitely have people from all represented districts who will be participating in use. So.
Well, they're happy, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay.
We are too. So Ontario will have 5.1 million federal funds and 2.1 million state. The Dalles 6.2 million federal and 3 million state. Neither of these last two armories are presently in our state budget for COPs. If they are funded by Congress, we will seek funds from the E-Board for the state match. So that's about $5
million. Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Kump.
Can you help me out? I think you said it before, but I missed it. What's a COP?
Certificate of Participation.
Participation, right.
Thank you.
That's a state acronym, so we have to pay for that. Not military.
Oh, well.
Okay.
Oh, well.
I got one left, sir.
I thought I'd let me go back through this. I think I explained it earlier.
Okay.
Okay.
Excuse me, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. General, do you know what we're paying on a biennial basis now for our debt service on the certificates of participation?
Participating, Mike, do you know that?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I guess for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. I don't have the exact number, but it's around $1.2 million per biennium that we're putting out right now, and I can get that number to you.
Any other questions this time? Please continue.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, the state is responsible for administration and housing of the National Guard. The Oregon National Guard is currently is the third largest holder of state facilities. We currently have 507 buildings with 3.6 million square feet of space. From a budget perspective, the Oregon National Guard has survived on a declining budget since 1999. Unfortunately, our facilities are showing the effects of those limited funds. Facilities are the major state expense of the National Guard. We reduced our state funding administrative and maintenance manpower over 60% since 1999, while at the same time, we have continued to generate a surplus of tax revenue to the state that exceeds the state general fund contribution by $13 million per biennium. This calculation does not factor in any services or supplies that we purchase with federal funds, and we do a lot of that, only payroll taxes that we generate. Our current governor recommended budget reflects the largest increase we have seen since 1999 and will greatly aid us in taking care of our soldiers and airmen. With that rather long preamble, I would like now to give you an overview of the current and past deployments, along with my best guess on what we have ahead of us. Does anybody have any questions about what we've covered so far?
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. General Byrne, I think what you just said deserves emphasis. I think what you just told us was that you're a net money maker for the state of Oregon to the tune of $13 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, if I might add, I just give your clerk some charts that we didn't put in the overhead slide, but it's part of our budget package, and you'll see a chart in here that basically gives you those numbers.
Great.
I think the essential part of that is that we collect this data only from the salaries that are paid to part-time guardsmen and full-time guardsmen. We have no clue in the general picture out of the $418 million of federal funds that come in here by any, and we don't know how much of that money for operations and supplies generates any tax income, but we can count revenue from salaries, and that's what we do count. And you'll see that's what we do.
Madam Chair, just for the record, you are pointing to the chart that's shown as page 18 on this.
Yeah, that's I extracted this from our budget presentation that we'll be doing later in the month.
This will be made part of the committee record. We're not sure what the number. Do you know what the number will be of the committee record?
C.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we certainly know, depending on which economist we talk with, that those dollars that you bring in, you know, roll over and over and over in our communities 4 to 8 times. Mm-hmm. So on behalf of the economy, you're an essential, and not only for the wonderful service and professionalism.
A good example, I was just down at Kingsley Field on Tuesday, and they gave us kind of a budget look at how they receive their money and the amount of economic impact they have on the Klamath Falls area. And Kingsley Field definitely has a huge impact on the economy in Klamath Falls.
Oh, yeah.
One example.
Again, I would just add that these four charts kind of describe the money situation and the employee numbers that we have, if you're interested in them.
Great. Thank you.
Go ahead. This is a rather busy slide. It begins with kind of the modern era of deployments in 1999. On the top part are Army deployments. And then on the bottom part are Air Force deployments, Air Guard deployments. Additionally, you will also see where we've been involved with state activations, primarily in fires. The largest one was a 2002 year with 1,600 soldiers. Also of note on this first slide also is that in 2003, 1,704 soldiers in 7 months were mobilized in the state of Oregon. If you go through this, OEF is Operation Enduring Freedom. In February, again, Operation Enduring Freedom.
We won't hold you to that. You may go ahead and use
I may go ahead.
Acronyms. Would that be all right?
Now that we know what it means.
Now that we know.
Well, and of course, any time as you're going through the slide. But the big point is, probably in this first slide, is that these, up until this point, these were rather short deployments, probably no more than 6 months for most of them. But since, and then about in this point, point in time, the deployments became longer, and we're currently with our current deployments of at least 18 months with the train-up and 12 months in theater with the people that we have currently in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Excuse me, for the record, Mr. I just want to point out that this chart is contained in exhibit. It's about halfway back in what I think is going to be exhibit B in the committee record.
Okay.
Yeah, we got it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Oakley.
General Byrd, you may be going to cover it. You can tell me just to shut up and wait on to the next period, but could you talk about you said length of an employment, can you share any wisdom with the committee on anticipated or discussed? As you well know, the SecDef is Secretary of Defense. I just...
That's a contraction.
The Secretary of Defense is considering with... the Secretary of Defense and the Assistant Secretary of Defense are pressing the President to extend federal statute to a three-year mobilization window. That allows soldiers to be mobilized for a three-year period instead of the existing two-year period, which is also part of the existing one-year period, which is compounded by the 179 day. Now, I'll only raise this to the committee. This is a very complex issue. But could you specifically, have you heard any more information on the President's intent to extend to that three-year mobilization window?
I have not heard anything. I was just recently in Washington, D.C. last week and made a presentation to National Guard Bureau on three issues that I considered very important for the state of Oregon. One of them had to do with resourcing and fully funding rear detachments, which are the people to stay back to take care of all the issues that when people are deployed, we refer to them as rear detachments. The second piece I talked to them was about fully funding and a model, again, for rear detachments as well as for family program, what I consider to be a fully funded rear family program model. I talked to them about that, and then I also talked to them specifically about length of deployments. And my recommendation to National Guard Bureau was reduce the length of deployments. So that's at least that's the Oregon National Guard stand on how we would like to do business. Rather than lengthen the time, it would be reduce it and maybe a little bit more repetitive. But I think the long deployments, as we will see over the next several years, may have a negative impact on us. But as far as to answer your question, I've not heard.
Thank you.
Okay.
And General Byrne, would that be reduce it even from the 18 months it is now?
It was put to me very well one time was that the soldier told me is that I could probably go away for a birthday, kid's birthday, one Christmas and one Thanksgiving, but two during a deployment is too much. So somewhere less than a year, maximum a year total length. That includes the train up and the deployment and the redeployment of the soldiers. As I explained before, since September 11, 2001, the Oregon National Guard has experienced the highest number of federal deployments since World War II. Prior to September 11th, we had already participated in deployments to Germany in support of the operations in Bosnia, and we deployed units to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Sinai Peninsula. We participated in Operation Northern Watch, which was an Air Force operation in northern Iraq, where F-15s flew missions from Turkey over northern Iraq prior to the war. These deployments foreshadowed our involvement in Operation Afghani Freedom, where our 641st Medical Battalion, which is a UH-60 Aero Medical Medevac Unit Company, was mobilized to Afghanistan, as well as Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, in support of ground operations, and also participated in operations at the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom as the war commenced. So essentially, they deployed right before the war and extended as the war was commencing. This slide, go to the next one. This slide depicts where our units are currently serving throughout the world. As you can see, we presently have 1,501 soldiers in Iraq with three units, as well as several individual deployments from the Air and Army Guard in the theater and throughout the world. The blue is air, and the green is the Army deployments.
General Byrne, you know, we just are incredibly proud of our military. Don't we have more, for the record, don't we have more troops deployed than any other guard in the United States?
No, I can get that information to you. But as far as a percentage of the National Guard population, we're real close to the number of people. With 1,500 of 6,100, that's 25% currently deployed. That's a large number. There are some National Guard organizations much larger than us. So,
probably the best, Madam Chairman, Colonel Caldwell, probably the best way to look at that is that we're a medium-sized state as far as size of guards go, with 6,100 Army Guard, 2,000 Air Guard. California, for instance, is, what, 31,000 guardsmen, something to that effect. So if you look at us in the band of medium-sized guards, we're right at the top with respect to that group.
Okay, that's how I should say it.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
But when you compare us against California, Florida, Texas, New York, Pennsylvania, these are huge states. There's 20,000 guardsmen. Georgia, 20-some thousand. So they got a lot of guardsmen. They're in one category. We're in the medium-sized states, and we're clearly at the top of that level.
And would it be right to say that probably 25% of their guard are involved or deployed at this time? Is it because of our expertise we have so many?
In some cases that would be true. If you take Idaho, for example, they're about 75% or 80% deployed right at this time, because when they our 3rd Battalion, 116th Armor, is part of the 116th Brigade, which is headquarters in Idaho. They virtually mobilized the whole state to deploy to Iraq, currently in Iraq. So, and they're a little bit of a smaller state. So they're a huge percentage of the population, their guard population has been deployed.
And it's because of their expertise, if I...
Yes. Yeah.
Which would be what?
In this case, they're a combat unit. While they were re-rolled somewhat, they're not fighting, for the most part, in armor, except probably for the units that had Bradley fighting vehicles. They have been re-rolled similar to what our 2nd Battalion is, to armored Humvees, to do their mission. So there was some required training, additional training, to how to do operations out of a Humvee. If you're used to being in a tank, that's a little bit different operation.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. It isn't just acronyms, I guess. Re-rolled?
Oh, okay. Re-rolled means that you are trained for a certain mission. In this case, if you were trained as a tanker, you basically focus on other tanks. And you have a certain mental process of how you go about doing combat. If you have a similar mission, but you're an armored Humvee, you have to rethink how you do your tactics, how you do your ways of doing business, basically. The usually with five crew members in a Humvee, each person has a certain role of what to do in that Humvee in a combat mission. And so you have to rework as a team to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Boquist.
If this is at least in the media, a big point of contention, and maybe the committee members, so I'd like to get the general to elaborate just slightly more on the training complexities of this. What we're talking about, and so if you'll indulge me just a minute, ma'am, is retraining infantry, in the case of Oregon, which is a good example, retraining infantry, which is mechanized, in many cases mechanized infantry, or light infantry, meaning foot infantry, into the operation of Humvee vehicles, or what we used in the old days called motorized infantry.
Yeah.
This may sound confusing, but this is welcome to the Department of Defense. could you, for clarification, General, give us just an example, maybe a snapshot of the 116 or the 162. What was the training cycle? How much training time, active days, were you given to retrain the unit to that new equipment and that new mission?
Let me kind of think of it two ways. If we had had additional amount of time pre-mobilization, we could have spent a lot more time in training in that motorized role. But because of the shortness of the mobilization cycle for 2162, that had to be done post-mobilization after they went on active duty. So when 2162 out of Eugene was activated, they had virtually no time whatsoever to train in a motorized role. So all of their training had to occur post-mobilization. So that period of time was about 4 or 5 months, wasn't it, Mike?
Yes, sir.
And so about 5 months. Since then, with the other units that are going into the same role, for example, the second next cycle with guys out of the soldiers out of Eastern Oregon, the 3116 and Golf Troop, the training was shortened a little bit. But also what had happened was that they had taken lessons learned from Iraq and incorporated that into the training. So that required basically the same amount of time. I'm sure there are efficiencies that you and I could probably sit down and work on efficiencies on how we could probably even shorten that further. But the Army's focus is to ensure that these folks are fully trained before they deploy them. And so I'm not going to argue with that.
Madam Chair, if I may follow up, just for the committee and not for General Byrne, just so you know, what we're talking about is a 3 or 4 month period minimum of train-up that our National Guard soldiers have been given on active duty. As example, to shift to the active component, my base defense battalion for the western sector of Baghdad when I was in Iraq was an air defense artillery battalion with a Hawk battery. I have no idea. I don't know if it's an acronym or what it is. It shoots missiles into the air and shoots airplanes down and sends stingers. And they are a track-mounted, mechanized unit of 852 men and women. And in less than 16 hours, they were converted to a 16 Bradley Fleet force of ground infantry. And that was their entire extended training period for the United States Army. And the very next day, they went out into infantry tactics and assumed an entire sector of western Baghdad. And there were 17 casualties, but luckily not killed, within the first 3 or 4 days.
Those were active duty soldiers?
Those were active duty soldiers. And so what we were able to do ourselves, since we were, frankly, not well defended, is we committed our own infantry forces that we had to retrain them over a 10-day period. So eventually each of those soldiers got 10 days of infantry training, which therefore reduced their casualty rate down. The second example I give to you is we magically, in a matter of several days in the active component, decided that all of the field artillery was going to become military police. And there were two plans for the execution of that on active component. The first one was, God bless you, go,
yeah.
And they were converted. And the second thing was a 30-day program. And so the Army itself is struggling with this. And so I guess my point here is, despite there are a lot of problems that we have getting our National Guard and our Army Reserve Forces going, that we're actually doing a much better job today in getting them prepared. And the last comment I make, Madam Chair, is that I had active component, reserve component, and National Guard units as my striker companies. The two best striker companies I had were one from the Indiana National Guard, one from Florida National Guard. They were vastly superior to the active component forces.
Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Bert. That's a good bit of information. Thank you very much, Representative Boquist.
Representative Boquist will probably, during the period of time that you're working together, will probably also point out some other inconsistencies that occur, and I'll leave him to do that.
said, well, General, I have the luxury to do that. You don't.
That's right.
Well, I'm open to suggestions on this side.
I will. I'll give those to you.
I think we just got several in this previous part.
Let's see. This slide shows you basically where we are throughout the world. You notice the other thing on this is that the difference between the Army units and the Air Force units, primarily the Air Force units are done in smaller increments, and you basically see them a lot of ones. Those are individual replacements, and then in Singapore, which is a larger piece of 75, but primarily the Air Force deploys their people differently than the Army does. We deploy as units and for longer periods of time. This is my personal opinion. I think that the Air Force has by far the best model of how to go about mobilizing, deploying, and redeploying people. It's a great process. Very, very small impact. It has an impact on the families and the airmen, but it has less of an impact than it would have on Army soldiers.
So is that a progressive deployment?
They run in a cycle. They refer to them as Air Force Expeditionary Force concept, and they program those things out several years in advance, and so you know several years in advance when your deployment's going to occur. Gives you time to get all your preparation done, and then you know when you're going to go, when you're going to return fairly readily. Of course, they deal in a different environment than the Army does. Ours is less predictable. It kind of depends on what's going to happen. As we watch the events in Baghdad and Iraq over the next couple of days, that should have an impact on what's going to occur, but we can't, as you can well tell, we can't predict what's going to happen. Next slide, please. This is basically a footprint of the 2nd Battalion, and you see armories basically in central coastal part of the state of Oregon: Cottage Grove, Eugene, Salem, Corvallis, Coos Bay, Newport, and the state headquarters in Salem. But this does not depict that we also have members from other communities within the state that made up that unit, some from southern Oregon and some which was Roseburg area, and also from the Woodburn area. So in order to put that task force together, we had to take people from those predominant areas. And I mention that only because that has an impact on how our rear detachment does their operations, and it also has an impact on the family program because they have to cover a larger area. The 2nd Battalion is assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division of Baghdad. This unit has its own headquarters in Cottage Grove with units in Eugene, Corvallis, Newport. Also, we transferred units from Troop E out of Woodburn, along with volunteers from the 1st Battalion, 186th Infantry, from Ashland and Roseburg, to fill this unit to its mobilization requirement. This unit deployed with 704 soldiers from Oregon last January, and they are scheduled to come home in March. This unit has been in some of the most difficult and dangerous areas in Iraq, and have sustained numerous casualties, resulting in 8 soldiers being killed in action since their deployment. Additionally, we have sent over 100 replacements to that organization since they deployed. As you can see by this area depicted on this slide, this battalion has a large area of responsibility, and I would neck that down a little bit further to one section of Baghdad, which is basically the northeast section of Baghdad. And while my notes have 2.5 million, it's actually 1.5 million of Iraqis who inhabit this area. They are next to the infamous Seder City, with a mix of religious sects and a large span of economic control, as well as being next to the Green Zone, which has further created challenges for the unit. From all reports from the 1st Cavalry Division, this unit has set a very high standard of excellence and is viewed as a premier unit by its active duty command. I visited them in September and spent a week with them in September. Went through their area of responsibility. They have 3 major areas of responsibility, not only security mission of the area, but also a training mission. They train two Iraqi National Guard companies. But also, they also have a civil affairs mission, which is coordinating with the local leaders and some development within their area of responsibility. The second unit we are currently have in Iraq is the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry, headquartered in Le Grand, with units from Baker City, Ontario, Pendleton, Hermiston, and the Dalles. Also serving with the 116th Brigade Combat Team, but not part of the 3rd Battalion, is Troop G from Redmond. The 3rd of the 116th deployed in August and arrived in Iraq in December. They are scheduled to return in December of this year. They have just recently moved into their forward operating base near Kirkuk.
Did they get to come home? Or is it next December?
Next December. The 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, will be coming home at the end of March and April time frame. Right now we're looking at an April time frame for them to return. As you can see on the map, Kirkuk, Baghdad's there, and Kirkuk's just north. And sustained their first combat injury last week when a soldier was wounded when his convoy was hit with an improvised explosive device, or IED. The soldier sustained wounds and a broken leg and has been transferred to Germany and is expected to return to the United States soon. Our third unit currently in Iraq is a company from F Troop, 1st of the 182nd Cavalry from Lebanon, Oregon, augmented by soldiers from the 2nd of the 218th Field Artillery of the 41st Brigade. They are expected to deploy sometime in the next 2 weeks. They're actually still down in Louisiana. The fourth unit is the Alpha 249th. No, we got the Lima. This Lima 151 is the Aviation Maintenance Organization, and they're currently also located in Iraq. We're a little out of sequence, but we'll go ahead. Our third unit in Iraq is a company from F Troop, but we just talked about that. Also, a fourth unit we have is the Alpha 249th Aviation from Salem, Oregon, with two Sherpa transporting soldiers in the Iraq Theater of Operation. Currently, they are located in Iraq. Dell Company 113 Aviation from Pendleton, Oregon, which was mobilized 2 weeks ago, is currently training at Fort Sill and will deploy to Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan in December, saw the site that they're going to be located, talked to the company commander and the first sergeant, and received some very good information that I gave to our people in Oregon prior to their going to training. So it was a very good visit I had with them. They will take five cargo CH-47s with them, which gives us some concern because we have utilized them extensively the past summer during forest fire season. And to cover that, we plan to relocate four UH-60 helicopters from Salem to Pendleton for the summer. So good there? Okay.
I have a look.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're going to be located, CH-47s will be located in an air base down here in the southern part in Kandahar. I was there again last month. I was especially pleased with security and the situation that was occurring around that area.
Is it the maintenance condition of the CH-47s you're worried about?
No, actually the CH-47s are well maintained. We have a great maintenance organization that takes care of them. I have no concerns about their maintenance. The unit that was flying there that these will be replacing, we're flying, as a company, we're flying 700 hours a month, which is kind of the maximum amount of hours, and they've been doing that. But their operation rate, the OR rate, they were running for the last 2 months was 90%, which means, one, that they're getting the supplies that they need in order to maintain the equipment. Two, they have the tools they need to do the job. And three, the people are very highly motivated and very proud of what they do. So
I should say that is extraordinary.
That it is, especially for that type of an aircraft.
Yes.
Yeah. This slide, Delta 113, go to the next slide, please. This slide probably is the most graphic example of what we have deployed since 9/11. As you can see, as we look at this slide, we have taken virtually, and it looks real similar to the previous slide, doesn't it? We have deployed basically individuals from every army and every community that we have an army within the state of Oregon. As we look at the slide, and if I can get my pointer to work again here, the only area, well, you know Portland. The only units really that large size units that we haven't deployed are out of the Portland area, and that is the 41st Brigade headquarters, as well as the 141 Support Battalion. And those plus another headquarters are virtually the only battalion headquarters we have not deployed. They are scheduled for deployment to Afghanistan in mid-2006 for 1 year deployment. That will take approximately 1,500 additional soldiers in 2006 out of the state of Oregon who will deploy to Afghanistan, and will be augmented by, at that time, they'll be augmented anywhere from 700 to 1,000 soldiers from other states to fill out their organization. Their mission will be a training mission to the Afghan National Army. I talked to the brigade commander who currently has that mission, he sees that mission about 6 to 8 months ahead of schedule. So when the 41st Brigade takes that mission over, I fully anticipate that they will have a very good, well-established mission location infrastructure, the places where they will stay. They'll all be well-developed, so our soldiers will be well taken care of at that time.
That is great to hear.
Then next slide, please. This slide depicts the 1st Battalion 186 Infantry. They deployed to a peacekeeping mission in 2001. They had a peacekeeping mission along the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. My pointer is not working. But if you look at the map, if you go down to the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula and go halfway up the peninsula on the east side, they basically manned outposts along that area. Very successful mission. They deployed just after 9/11, redeployed back to the United States. That was an example of one of the shorter tours. They were gone approximately 9 months with train up and redeployment. Next slide. This slide probably the most graphic example since 9/11. We already talked about that. The Air National Guard has had over 1,200 airmen on federal active duty for the year following the attack on September 11th. Today, the Air National Guard continues to operate a 24/7 F-15 interceptors at the Portland Air Base and is ready to deploy anywhere in the world within 48 hours. I might add that the Oregon Air National Guard, the F-15s, were the first, on 9/11 on that date, was the first F-15, which has a basically a combat air patrol interceptor role, air defense role, was the first one in the United States to be fully functional and operational within the United States.
Is that right? Yeah. It's great.
Very, very, very good organization. We also operate a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week command post here in Salem at the Anderson Readiness Center. Your Oregon National Guard is a robust, world-class organization which is engaged in numerous missions assigned by the National Command Authority. At the same time, we are your neighbors, your co-workers, and your state force in time of need by our Commander-in-Chief, the Governor. We believe that our soldiers and airmen are twice the citizen. We believe that the modern National Guard is what our Founding Fathers envisioned when they wrote our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Over the past hour, I have attempted to give you a quick overview of our force, some of our current challenges that we are facing, and I hope I have given you a glimpse of this marvelous force comprising our state's best citizens, and I will now take your questions. Thank you.
Well, General Byrne, this is an excellent overview. I'm sure many of us did not have any idea that we had done so much. we, you know, hear a little bit, you know, now and then in the news, but to get the full scope is just incredible, and we are so proud of your leadership and certainly proud of these troops, these military men and women.
Well, I maintain anywhere I go we have the best National Guard in the United States.
I believe it.
Army and Air, and I'm very proud, and I don't mince words with people when they ask questions.
Well, at this time, I personally would just want to thank you for having the courage and the leadership to appear on 60 Minutes and to advocate on behalf of our servicemen and women. I thought that was incredibly courageous, and most importantly, I think has had a tremendous impact on Washington, D.C., and we're moving forward now. I hope, I don't know if it's fast enough, but with your solutions for, you know, more adequate protection of our in our equipment.
Yeah.
And I just am so proud of you, and
thank you very much. I will pass that on to the soldiers and airmen.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. Are there questions of General Byrne?
Okay. Madam Chair, yes, I just have one. General Byrne, also thank you, but you've given us a vast amount of information. With your own personal bias, if you may, what would you say is your highest need right now for the Oregon National Guard?
That affects the state. I would say what I would do is stick with what we have gotten through the governor's budget.
Okay.
And the governor's budget has, in conjunction with the governor and the staff, we've put together several important items that we are going to work through. So I would refer you to the governor's budget and those items that we're working on.
Good. I have a copy of that.
Good. Thank you.
Yes.
You're on that committee, huh?
I'm on that committee.
Representative Barnhart.
I think this may be a similar question, so you can give the same answer. When we had a conversation earlier, one of the issues that we discussed was the issue of recruitment. And I'm wondering if there are specific things that this committee could be working on from your point of view, not necessarily budgetary issues, yeah, but things that may have to do with making the National Guard service more attractive, more amenable, and thus ease the ongoing and forever issue of recruitment.
I think as you asked that question, the first thing that came into my mind is the first thing that we have to do is when we talk to people, we need to make sure that they're informed of the realities of life. And the realities of life in this current environment is that there's a potential for deployment. There's a potential for being a separation from family and friends, and that's the first thing that is something that I have no control over. We have no control over, or you as a committee have no control over. The other piece would be, if you look at the budget, I think the incentives that the governor has assisted us with, some incentives that we look at within the budget, I think those would be very helpful. Mike, did you have anything else?
Madam Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I think that the incentives that the General's talking about is the Governor's proposed that we $700,000 in his budget. One of those incentives is the major portion of that $700,000 would be allocated toward education. Education not for the soldiers, as they've got federal resources to go to, but for families and family members. We're hoping that'll make an impact on some of our, middle management, if you will, the more seasoned veterans that we have in our organization. We would like them to stay. They're 10, 12 years worth of service. They've got great capability. They've got great training and leadership capability. We don't want them to leave. But what we find is that the two major areas where they have difficulties is in employment, in their job, and also with their families. This will help part of that. The other incentives that we're discussing right now that the governor is not locked into yet, but I think pretty close, is to assist in hunting and fishing licenses, make those either reimbursable by this budget amount and or license for your car, a car. Those are minor, on the big scheme of things, I think they're nice to have, not necessarily going to convince anybody to stay. I think that's more toward that education piece. As I said, what we've found and when we've reviewed our data is that we typically lose people, believe it or not, at about the 9th or 10th year. And usually after that period of time, a young soldier who enlists is 18, 19, single, doesn't have a house, doesn't have maybe a car payment. By the time they come up for their 6th year or their 10th year, right in those two breaks, they've acquired probably a job that they see themselves staying in for a longer period of time. They see themselves as they have a wife and or a spouse and 1.5 children and a house payment. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, their life's changed dramatically in that period of time, and this becomes very, very hard for them to do. There's a separation in the impending deployment. So I know there's going to be some discussion, and I know there's some discussion right now in this building talking about incentives for employers and tax incentives for soldiers and other things. And I've seen those. I just heard about the conversations. And I think we need to look at that perhaps as some other means as we get down the road in this session, is maybe there is something there for an employer to help our employers. Because frankly, when we talk to our people who leave, number one's job, because they now have a job at 6 or 10 years that they see themselves being in for a long period of time. They don't see that it's not their fifth or sixth job in the last 5 years. And they don't want to lose that job. And it's the subtle pressures they get from their employers or their fellow workers that they find difficult to handle. And then secondly, it's the family. And the family is, of course, paramount to us and everything we do. And we're trying desperately to try to make that a robust situation. I might add one other thing that we are going to do, and we're looking for federal money to do it because we feel it's a federal responsibility. But as these soldiers return from active duty and return back to Oregon, is we're going to have a lot of issues that the federal government is responsible to do. Representative Boquist was at our meeting yesterday. We have put together a working group of all the veterans organizations, the VA, ODVA, and numerous other people, VFW, Disabled American Veterans, et cetera. And we're trying to figure out how we better serve our soldiers so when they come home we don't have people sliding through the crack, ending up needing service. And as you saw on the map, we've got people scattered from border to border in this state, north, south, east to west. And sometimes those services don't exist only at the county level. And we're fearful that our soldiers will end up popping up with needs, and they'll pop up in their law enforcement system, not the proper place where they can get mental health care. So we're putting together a team right now, and we're using some of our state funds because we haven't got the federal government to come through with this yet. So we're using state monies in our current budget, and we're redirecting those to put together a 3-person team to start coordinating all this effort and make sure that we get this information not out to not only the families but when the soldiers return, and then continue on with that, because this is 6, 7, 8, 10 months a year later that we may see some of these manifestations of issues, and you may see that when we get to our budget too as well. So those are some of the things. It's just a matter of, does that help, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
One thing of note also is that as we try to be very proactive on the retention piece, you may have seen something on television where we had a recruiter retainer who's going to be going over to Iraq about 2 months before the organization returns. I don't know if you saw that, but on a proactive basis, I determined rather than wait till the soldiers got home, if there were some issues, if they were potential for, there's a fairly large recruiting bonus for soldiers if they reenlist in theater, and it's tax free.
Okay.
And so I had someone specifically go over and spend 2 months with them, but also talk about any educational, military educational issues, and also some of these same programs that we're working with in the state, so to make the soldiers aware of all the things that are being worked on the state level to potentially keep them. It is our goal and stated goal in the Oregon National Guard is that if a soldier airman is going to leave, it's not because of something that we have in our control, mm-hmm. but it's something that is totally external. So our goal is to do everything we can possible for both the soldiers and families.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you. You mentioned the retention bonus and that's tax-free. That's currently tax-free, federal and state?
Good question. I believe that it's that's the That's the federal money. I'm not sure. We'd have to look into that. Mike and
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, it's tax-free federal taxes. It's not tax-free state taxes, unless it's paid before they get back into back to Oregon. Yeah. And if they receive the money before they get back in the state of Oregon, then it would be money received on federal active duty, so therefore it would be tax-free. There is a Senate bill in right now that is actually going to assist in one example of that when we had a unit deployed that ended up getting assigned back to, part of them got assigned back to Umatilla Army Depot. And suddenly those incomes became taxable in the state of Oregon, and by luck of the draw, their fellow guardsmen who was on active duty across the river at Yakima Firing Center did not get taxed. So we have a bill in to fix that, but that's only for that specific time. So if we were going to do this bonus, then that would probably take another piece of legislation.
I have a question regarding employer incentives. What kind of incentives do you propose?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we have not proposed any. When I mentioned that, I mentioned it in the light that I know that some other people have been discussing that here, some other of your colleagues. Again, any proposal of a tax incentive for employers is you know, you got revenue and then you've got, you know, and I don't have a specific proposal. We do not have a specific proposal. For us to do that would automatically then show a deduction in the revenue side of the house, and I don't want to be responsible for that one.
From the governor.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure that the commander-in-chief would have real difficulty if we were down here proposing that we take money out of his budget. So, and we don't want to get in that box. But we would certainly advise and suggest based on those. And there may be some mechanisms that could be done that would be enhance that opportunity for employers. And I know that there's also discussions in the Congress about the very same issue. And there are some proposals that are in that will be introduced in this session of Congress that will add incentives to employers on the federal tax side. And whether they make it through or not. So I don't know. This body may want to focus on resolutions to Congress to encourage them to do that as well as other things. And that's something we'd be willing to help you with respect to that.
You'll be a valuable resource.
Yeah. I've left my card with Jim, and if you don't have it, please, he's got one, and feel free to call me anytime, and we'll do all we can to assist you in any of your endeavors. Can I dodge that okay?
Can I cut my mouth?
Any other Representative Boquist?
Well, Madam Chair, I only have 8 or 9 questions, so I think...
Go right ahead.
I'm going to move them.
I should state them for the record, and okay. Then General Burns and his staff could, you know, prepare answers and bring them back.
Okay, that'd
so
be great.
If you'll just indulge me, Madam Chair, I'll state them for the record, and then I will explain them in person with... Phil Caldwell and General Byrne, so that they bring answers back. They're all relevant to the committee. The first one is I think we need to appoint an expansion of federal versus state. And this is specifically a word question for General Byrne, because I know what the governor, he has the governor as the commander-in-chief. But there are many of the issues that they don't raise, for example, such as education and others, that if the federal government fails to comply, it falls to us. We're going to pay in the counties. It was alluded to here by Colonel Caldwell that we're going to pay one way or the other. So we're either going to pay in our federal tax dollars, and if not, and we don't participate in a solution at the federal level, we in this committee are going to pay anyway. And so there's a whole federal versus state series of issues. That includes education and an expansion of what federal education programs exist and what state education programs exist and where there may be shortfalls. The second issue is employment, is bringing the committee up to speed on how many of the individuals are employed or unemployed upon deployment and how many of them come back unemployed when they get back. And that is an atrocious rate, by the way, Madam Chair. I won't quote it right here, but I'll let them in a later time address that issue of those individuals who come back who are unemployed and they're going to go to the veterans offices or to employment division and ask for assistance, and it's not as good as their briefing. I sent a veteran to the employment office yesterday, and I'll report back later to the committee of the results of their visit, but it did not match the presentation we received. Should not surprise anybody. Further, I mean, on the issue of recruiting retention challenges and some of the things that were brought up, like car licenses, hunting license, so on and so forth, and exact status that. Mike, I'll give you a whole list of this later. The second, another item is TRICARE medical issues. What is the status in the National Guard and the reserve components, as you would understand it, of the success of TRICARE? TRICARE is the medical plan that covers these people and their families, since there's not a military installation close by. And of course, if they don't get coverage, where do they go? To the counties, under the old Oregon health care plan, and if we come back, we pay the bill anyway. So if the feds are failing, won't comment, then we pay for that. Another issue is the definition of veterans as they see it, because as was brought up by General Byrne, the Air Guard is manning a 24/7 process in air defense, and there are many other components of the Army National Guard and reserve components that are doing 24/7 type functions, and how are they doing it? Are they doing this on, I'm going to have to take the active duty ADSW, help me here, Colonel Caldwell, or ATA.
Active duty special work.
Okay, good. How they're being paid, i.e. they don't meet the 179-day qualification, but they may be in the seat of a F-15, F-16 intercepting an inbound missile, but they're not in combat, so therefore they're not a veteran. I mean, what is that definition, and how are we paying these people, and should we at the state level change our definition? That's an ongoing problem we have. More clarification, I think, on the maintenance backlog at the armories. As it does have a community impact, especially related to, we use armories in some cases, and we use guard equipment for fighting fires. I have my Ag Natural Resource hat on here. And those guard equipment is leaving. Those helicopters are leaving the state. And the National Air Tanker Fleet, I think you know this, Madam Chair, has been reduced to, I think, 7 air tankers right now because of a federal safety issue. And the CH-47s are leaving the state, and we're not going to have those on hand to do that. And so those equipment issues that go from there. And I think rather than overburden the committee at this time, that gives kind of an overview to the answer of, if you'll indulge me, Madam Chair, to Representative, I think, Farr's question. There were some other issues brought up that I will bring back, and Representative Hunt will bring back once the minutes come out of this joint meeting that happened yesterday, that are not really, we can't hang the albatross on General Byrne through the governor, but there are issues that were brought up that are non-military department issues that we need to address in relationship to yours. And with that, I'll just be quiet, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, question.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Did anyone else notice that Representative Buzz used an acronym?
I had one credit left, right, General Byrne? I had, so here is.
Well, now, since when did General Byrne become your accountant?
Since I loaned him my dollar.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I answer to the civilian leadership in the community.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes.
Just one of Representative Buzz lists is, and probably clear enough right now, is the definition of the veteran. He's absolutely correct with respect to what the federal definition of veteran is, and we've asked our congressional delegation and the National Guard Association of the United States, and I think the Reserve Officers Association as well, has been pushing the federal Congress to change that definition. Again, I think there's two opportunities here. One is for a resolution to support those changes. Two, in our state, the state of Oregon, the definition of veteran is in the Constitution. So you're going to have to send something to the people, and otherwise it will not change. But I do believe it would make a positive statement. And again, I do know that there's one of your colleagues is also thinking about this. And so
at the top of our list,
you may see that come out in a draft bill here at the end of this week or next week. I understand there's one being worked on, but.
I think the critical thing that you're pointing out was that the definition of a veteran has a time orientation versus an event orientation or a location orientation, and both those should be seriously considered in how they define a veteran.
One other comment on that, we've got probably 250, 300 different people in the headquarters, both the Army and the Air National Guard. Their primary mission in life is to prepare these soldiers who are going and coming from active duty. They're working just as hard and just as many days and just as many hours, but the fact that they're not on federal active duty, they are not a veteran, whereas if they were sitting at Fort Lewis doing exactly the same thing, or any air base or naval base in the United States of America or worldwide, they're not getting shot at, unlike their counterpart on active duty, but yet this person is in the Guard, they're not a veteran, the other person is. Makes absolutely no logical sense to us, and no logical sense with respect to how we are a large, huge part of this entire military operation. Over 40%, almost 50% of the total people in Iraq right now are National Guard or Reserve. So, I mean, it's time to change, and Congress needs to be told that.
In a larger picture, and Representative Boquist will understand this, is basically the system we're dealing with is a Cold War system. And by bits and pieces, it's being drug into the present.
Yeah.
But it's not comprehensive, and I think that that's where we need to be moving things.
Madam Chair, in that line of what you're saying, just one other example outside, because we're talking National Guard, but for the committee, my first SEAL detachment in Mosul, we were mortared the very first night, was on annual training from Coronado, California. 29 days, right? Correct me. 29 days of annual training. That's the old weekend warrior,
yeah.
2 weeks a year. That's how they came to Iraq, on annual training for 29 days.
Oh, wonderful.
Wow. Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Hunt.
If I could ask Representative Boquist, were you working in a zoo or a SEAL?
We were working actually in 18 inches of mud.
So SEAL would be an acronym.
SEAL was an acronym.
That's a two.
Uh-oh.
Okay, that's a setup. Well, this is, you know, I want to be sure. This whole committee mission is so serious to us. So I'm glad that at least we can have a bit of humor with these acronyms, especially for us who are dumb. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation about the definition of a veteran. There's been a lot of discussion in the committee so far, and we've only met a couple of times about what that is, and a lot of disagreement about what it means. It would be very useful for us to have a definitive statement of what that currently means. And if I could make one additional comment, that being the question, the comment being, it sounds to me as though the current law on the definition of a veteran really deals with the exception period that you, General, were describing from the close of World War II through the end of the Cold War, rather than the normal time during which the National Guard, the militia, is actually the main force of the United States military.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we need to be doing as we rethink the term veteran, and as we try to think about, work on how we describe that term, and as we think about benefits that ought to apply, we need to be thinking more in the old and new model, rather than the exception model, as you were describing.
Right.
If we can do that, we'll get to a set of definitions or regulations about these things that will make sense from the standpoint of recruitment, retention, honoring our troops, and making sure that our country is adequately defended in the future. If we don't get there, then we'll be muddling along with the kind of difficulties that we've had during this adjustment period. And I'm assuming that all of us in this room, at least, are interested in getting there and doing it right.
I agree. Is that we need to start doing a switch in the head, as, you know, so change the soul on it, is the saying that things are not going to be like they were before. We need to think about what is normal now is the way it's going to be in the near and foreseeable future. So your comments are very very appropriate.
Thank you, sir.
And General Byrne, do we get any Homeland Security money in the Guard?
We do have some Homeland Security money, and it usually comes. For example, our civil support team is a weapons of mass destruction team that we're standing up here in the state of Oregon in support of the state and the governor. There's federal funding. We also, the other Homeland Security, correct me if I'm right on this or wrong on this, Mike, but it comes into the state and it's done through the Homeland Security Office in the state of Oregon. Primarily, that's where money comes, unless it comes strictly through National Guard channels to us.
So would there be, for example, grants you would apply for with the Homeland Security that maybe could enhance some of these properties or
Madam Chair,
training?
The best, I guess the best explanation is that we have no operational monies other than what comes with the civil support teams, which is funded by DOD. And those are really designed for state and local government to use in times of a nuclear, biological, or chemical incident. and that's what these teams are designed to do. 22 of them full-time. They're being trained right now. It takes 2 years to train them, and the DOD also provides the equipment, the suites, the vehicles, the test equipment, and all the super-duper technical stuff. So we've screened for that. We've got 24 people in training right now. They won't be ready to go probably for another 14 months or so until they're certified and all their equipment's on board. That is DOD money. The Homeland Security Administration, who does have a fairly large pot of money, does come through the Office of Homeland Security here in Oregon. We compete as anybody else does, and we have been successful in receiving funds through the governor's office and their way they met this, divide this money up. That's been for construction items for security only. We can't necessarily use it for, you know, fixing a boiler, fixing a roof, fixing a window, improving. If we could relate a project, for instance, we've got one project in for this next round of funding for cameras for video surveillance on some of our more sensitive locations. Everything else basically comes through DOD. We have been increased in funds from the Department of Defense for security in personnel and in actual structures. We just finished a fence outside of our building that we were instructed basically to secure by the Department of Defense. Very, you know, you may have seen it. We've had comments on it about how nice it looks. It was very expensive. I can tell you that right now, and we've been criticized in some quarters for the amount of money we spent on it. We really didn't have an option. We got a plan hand-delivered to us, said you will build a fence, or we will pull these items out of your building. If we pull these items out of your building, we can't do business. We simply can't do business with the national authority without those types of mechanisms that we have inside of our structures. We got to secure it. It's an Osama bin Laden legacy is what it is. And it's unfortunate, but it is very expensive. Does that help you understand
that? Yes, it does. Okay, are there any other questions? Representative Hunt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier in your testimony, and I'm not actually finding it now, but you referenced that the construction needs that you face are often funded by certificates of participation. Is there a reason that you don't utilize general obligation bonds, which my understanding is would typically carry a lower interest rate and therefore a lower debt service burden over time?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the state, we run these through the Department of Administrative Services, and the state, as I understand it, and I'm not the expert, our budget analyst, Bam, could probably give you the chapter and verse, but that's the only mechanism we have available to us, and it is a form of bonding. The difference is, in the certificate of participation, is that the building that we put to that structure, or with that bond to, actually becomes part of the mortgage, if you will, and if the state was to fail in paying those bonds through general funds, then they could come back and have an equity interest in the structure that they were used on. So that's the difference, I guess, so between that and a regular general obligation bond.
Security.
Yeah, which basically puts the state at risk in a kind of a nebulous form. This is specific to the building, and that's why the state uses them, is my understanding. But I would caution that by maybe you go to LFO and say, hey, was he right? But I think I am.
Thanks.
Okay, LFO, lateral. I said it. That's your acronym. I didn't
think. Not paying people.
Legislative acronym.
Okay.
You all know that.
Oh, but no, I'm sorry. I don't know.
Okay, so say fiscal office.
I'll pay for that one, Kurt.
Okay, yeah. You set him up. You have to watch out for these people. Any other questions for the General or Colonel Caldwell? I want to ask Colonel Caldwell, do you have today, are you prepared to answer any other questions, or shall we wait and have you back with another list?
Well, based on the questions we have, I'd like to come back, but if you have other questions, I'd be happy to give you a stab at it today. I have a due out to you on a schedule for your committee. I will have that to you by Friday.
Great.
That's tomorrow, I think. So I will have that to your office tomorrow with a draft schedule for you to review for your committee to go out and look at our facilities. We're excited about that to get you out to see some of our activities and what we do on a daily basis. I think it'll give you a good idea of what the small force, actually it's 8,000 people, 2,000 of us are full-time basically, and you'll get to see the mix between the state employees, federally funded state employees,
generally funded state employees and the federally funded guardsmen, both active guard reserve and federal technicians. So we have a 4 to 5 employee mix to make this thing work and make it work right. And I think it'll really give you a really good idea of it's difficult sometimes to manage. It's like herding cats sometimes, but you'll be surprised, I guess. I think you'll be surprised when you see what kind of show we actually operate on.
We look forward to that. I do know many have asked the question about the family program that understood you set up initially at all of our in all our armories at all our companies. So there's a representative to the family within each.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd love to take credit for it, but I actually didn't do it. The family program really started in Oregon in about 1982-83. Informal. We've always had a family program. I've been in the National Guard now for, next month, 35 years. And we've always had it's a camaraderie, and families get together. Every adjutant general that I've ever served under has said, we will have family picnics, we will have Thanksgiving dinners, we'll have Christmas dinners, and you will deal with your families. 1981, 82, 83, right in that area, the federal government actually funded one person in the state of Oregon to be a coordinator for family programs, and it actually became formalized back then. We have now, and of course we've done this since that time, but it's all volunteer, and one of the things that we've seen since the deployments began has been this huge, vast vessel of expertise and support coming from the community. Family members, relatives, friends have all joined into this group and really made a marvelous difference. It's been difficult in some respects because I think for a lot of years you kind of go through the motions. You have that annual picnic, you have that annual Thanksgiving dinner, Christmas dinner, those sort of things. But now it's serious business. And it's amazing how well these groups have come together. And what's totally amazing to me is just how well connected they are. In fact, as we started receiving casualty notifications from the 2nd Battalion, frankly, the better information we were getting, much better information from the family program, our volunteers, than we were from the Department of Defense. More accurate, more timely, and much better.
Yeah.
And we knew things, they knew things before we knew them. And that was another phenomenon that we've experienced in this conflict, is that before this time, I mean, mail took 7 to 15 days. You know, we got instant communication now. We got a technological world and we frankly weren't ready for that. We didn't anticipate it. We didn't even think about it. We were too busy chopping wood to sharpen our axe. And, we just were. And all of a sudden, we were getting a real experience in the technological era. So, but the family programs have been extremely valuable to our overall operation. And General Byrne, I will, not because he's my boss, but in fact, he has taken that on as one of his major initiatives. And
great.
And I think that has really been emphasis. The reason we have a good family network right now is because of the Adjutant General's interest, because it really starts at the top.
I certainly have heard so much praise, and I've heard these people speak to many groups, and I'm in awe. I've just never seen a family. It's just a huge network looking after all the needs. You know, somebody needs, something electrical done. I mean, they can find it in a heartbeat. If they need money for freight to send over, certain items, I'm so impressed with it.
The big issue was focusing energies and getting a coordination of energies and resources. And Diane Gooding, who's the state family program coordinator, has done an exceptional job of coordinating at the state level. But really, the yeoman's work is being done at the family, at the company level. And those are all unpaid volunteers, and some of them put in 60 to 80 hours a week when things are not going so well, and a normal 40. This is all volunteer. And that was part of my presentation to the National Guard Bureau, was that we need to resource them a little better, so get them some money for what they're doing.
Okay, that's a good one.
I might say one other thing about overall volunteer in the state of Oregon. The communities have been extremely generous to us at this point. We have an Oregon National Guard Relief Fund, 501c3. We've never experienced this kind of outpouring from citizens in Oregon. That fund is very healthy right now. typically we were able to run about $20,000 to $25,000, most of which we taxed ourselves for. We would have events and say, everybody will come, won't you? And you'll pay double the dinner, won't you? So we can generate money for this relief fund. And now, right now, the fund has got a total cash value of about $140,000, total value of $200,000, I think, with some loans. The fund gives loans and grants depending on the situation and the circumstance, and we've been able to help families for no fault of their own. Things have gotten screwed up, their pay's gotten messed up, something's happened locally. The family program has been proactive. Community members who have no obvious connection to the Oregon National Guard have donated their time and money, and mainly money. And it's been a godsend to us so we could react and take care of a family in need, a person in need, immediately, not have to work through the bureaucracy, the red tape of the federal bureaucracy to get their pay unscrewed or whatever was the case may be. So we are very grateful to the citizens of Oregon who have felt that, you know, their part. And without that, we just wouldn't have that ability.
It's just incredible, and I sure commend you for what you've done to make that really go and grow. Also, I'd like to ask if you would come back at another time, and this is quasi-committee material or not, but if this committee has never heard the story about our Bend school program, it is beyond belief. It's the most incredible program. And
Youth Challenge Program?
Yes, the Youth Challenge Program. It is unbelievable. As long as I've been in the legislature, I have talked about it once a week to somebody at least. Many, many times encouraged people to just go there, and we're going to have that opportunity. Representative Comp would just really be interested in this as a school principal. Would you like a 98% or 99% success rate and no dropouts really of any degree for 10 years? It's just incredible. It's the program that says we're for young people who need to learn self-discipline. And this environment, is it 250 or 300 kids over there?
Madam Chairman, the class total is, we typically graduate 110, we take in 150. It's a voluntary program. Yeah. It's 22 weeks long. We're in the second week right now of the pre-challenge. We have 2 weeks of pre-challenge, which is, it's similar to boot camp. It's not a boot camp that Brian or I or anybody here would have experienced, or Representative Barnhart, I think you're a veteran as well, so you know what I'm... It's not that, but it's close. And that usually winnows out about 25, 30 kids who really didn't want to be there. And then the remainder, we have dropouts for different reasons after that, discipline or whatever. It is 20 weeks of high school. It's a 20-week high school program. That's what we are as a high school. And we 24/7, 7 days a week, and we go to school from about 7:30 in the morning until about 10 o'clock at night, and we have a smattering of different activities in between that.
We love it.
But it is it we remove all of the outside influences that most teenagers have that cause them to be struggling.
Amen.
And they can focus on high school, and we make sure they focus, and we have lots of folks there to make sure they do focus, and the results are astonishing. If you provide those opportunities for these kids to change. And that's what we do. We provide an opportunity for kids to change.
And it's voluntary. Mm-hmm. You're not committed. I think that's what is so awesome about it.
Yeah.
And I hope you'll bring back some of those who have been there, because when you hear this, the testimony of these parents, I mean, parents and kids, you know, weep and say, you know, my life has been totally changed. And the parents will say, I didn't know this young man. I mean, he came back, he'd make his bed, you know, keep order, cut his hair, you know, got all the tattoos off his body. Not that that was a big issue, but, you know, he didn't have a good image of himself at the time. And it's just incredible, the life-changing aspects. And so I advocate that that be one of our bills, and I guess we'll talk about it later. I think if we had this facility in the four corners of the state, and the federal government would resupply the money for this, and we could hire this National Guard leadership to run it. I just think these 30% kids who are dropping out of our schools can have another chance and really get redirected positively in their lives. It's just phenomenal. I hope we'll get to hear more about this again, but I want to ask Representative Cummings.
Well, Madam Chair, I am very aware of this organization, and I have been acquainted with a young female student that just went through the program, and she would not have gotten her diploma or graduated without the program. Without a doubt.
Great.
I mean, she had already withdrawn from high school and then applied for the program and got in. And, yeah, it makes a huge difference.
It's phenomenal.
Madam Chair, I might just invite you to the last handout I gave. And it's a little bar chart. It talks about general fund comparisons since 1989. The reason I'm drawing you to that, because you'll see from 03 to 05 and 05 to 07, there's quite a steep increase. And then part of the reason that is increased, that graph line has increased, is two principal reasons. One, the governor's added the $700,000 we spoke about in his budget for National Guard enhancements. Secondly, it's the first time since we've had the Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program that it's actually been in the governor's budget in 10 years. So this governor chose to put it in his budget. He believes in the program. He's seen the results. And so we've actually got we're starting out with a budget line item, which is not happened in my 10 years of dealing with this program.
I'm delighted that he's noticed it.
He's noticed it. He supports it, and we're very grateful for that. I'll tell you right now, this is not a recruiting tool. However, about 25 to 30% of the kids that come through there actually end up in the military in one capacity or another. The other 75 percent don't. They go back to school, back to their high school, and reintegrate and graduate with their class. They go on to college. They go on to other activities. So it's not. If it was a recruiting program, it'd be a poor use of dollars to recruit from. I can tell you that. And that isn't why we do it. It was actually a program started at National Guard Bureau because we believe that we are a community-based organization. As you saw the map up there with all the different places we're in, our armories are out in our communities. We draw our citizen soldiers from those communities. And if our communities are not healthy, and the National Guard Bureau felt that we could add a benefit to the communities that perhaps wasn't out there. So they came up with this program 10, 12 years ago, and we were fortunate enough to migrate into it.
Outstanding. I look forward to see it in operation. Are there any other questions at this time?
I'd like to make just one comment,
okay.
If I may. Thank you.
Colonel, I'm actually not a veteran, but I think it's important that we recognize that it is a responsibility of Oregonians, especially those of us who aren't veterans, to make certain that those who are get the services and the honor that they deserve. Thank you.
Absolutely. Any other comments? Well, if not, at this time we just want you to know how grateful we are for your service to the world. And certainly to Oregon and for us and for all of our Oregonian families. We are immensely blessed to have your leadership, and we're grateful. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Joel Byrne.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you.
Major in Kabul. We appreciate you very much. Look forward to you coming back. And if we could just be at ease for a moment. Could we? And just have one picture? Okay. Is there anyone who needs... who would like to speak today who isn't signed up? Okay, well, if not, well, then we can adjourn the meeting. And if you would just stay for 1 minute, we hope the journal will have a picture with us. Thank you. This committee is adjourned.